This is part two of a series. Actually, it's only a two-part series. looking at muscle-invasive urothelial cancer and bladder-sparing approaches. We did a podcast with Matt Galsky earlier in the year, paper of the month. It was released last week. And in that paper, Matt described muscle-invasive bladder cancer patients, about 80 patients who received neoadjuvant, four cycles of neoadjuvant GemCis with concurrent nivolumab. We know from the recent 901 trial that GemCis plus nivolumab associated with slightly higher response rates than GemCis alone. A little bit of controversy around OS signals and other bits and pieces, but because of that maintenance period. But in this neoadjuvant trial, he then also gave that maintenance period in those patients who had achieved a clinical complete response. Clinical complete response being distinct from pathological complete response, looking at things like urine cytology and MRI lesions and TURBT results, cystoscopy results. And he showed about a 40% clinical complete response rate, whether or not that correlates accurately with past CR we discussed. But actually, the relapse rate in that population was in that clinical complete response population was modest. It was about, about 75% of those patients did not relapse. And that's a pretty good outcome. And so the conclusion of that podcast was that there are bladder-sparing approaches, and it's possible to give chemotherapy and then potentially nivolumab and induce durable remissions in a significant group of patients, therefore sparing cystectomy. Mikhail and I chatted over the weekend. We chat about all sorts of things. and Mikhail came up with a few points which he thought could evolve this podcast. And so I'm going to welcome Mikhail van der Heijden from NKI, great friend of the show, and involved in EV302 and 901, but also Nabucco, which was also a paper of the month, I believe, Mikhail, back in the day. Nabucco was a study looking at neoadjuvant ipi-nivo in urothelial cancer. And Mikhail, welcome to the show. And do you want to give us, that's a very long introduction, I apologize, by the way.
Typical.
Welcome to the show, firstly, but also, do you want to just talk a little bit about how you see the field at the moment in this setting and where it's going?
Yeah, great for being here again, and thanks for the invitation, Tom. And indeed, we chatted a bit. I thought this podcast would be about Brian's swimming career, but apparently
I'm more than
happy
to talk about that.
I guess we're going to talk about other things today. So I think this is a topic that is very near to my heart, I must say. I think this is a topic that a lot of patients are, rightfully so, asking about. Is there a chance that I can preserve my bladder? And I think we are now at sort of a fork in the road where we can go several directions, and I think we should be open to all the possibilities that all these new systemic therapies are giving us, and ways to improve not only outcome but also the things that patients really care about, which is also their bladder function and for example their sexuality, which is often a bit forgotten in the whole mix. So basically, we're now at a point where we have several really powerful new systemic therapies in a metastatic setting. You mentioned it, Checkmate 901. Of course, what's on everybody's mind is EV302 as well, with EV Pembro producing spectacular outcomes in the metastatic setting. And I'm sure, these treatments will make it to the non-metastatic setting. And if they are as effective as they are in the metastatic setting, I think there's really an opportunity for patients to provide bladder preservation. So bladder preservation up until now is, the implementation is has a lot of variation in between countries. So some countries like the UK have a lot of use a lot of bladder sparing approaches with chemo radiotherapy, whereas some other countries, I think mainly the US, it's the implementation is quite low. And I think we can now think about how to move forward. I think Matt Gelski showed one of the ways to do this, which I think has been some great work that was recently published, where you give powerful induction therapy and then you strictly define a clinical complete response and try to and then not give any consolidative treatment at all. So I think this is an approach that is interesting. It's also attractive. However, I think there could be other ways to do it. I think with all these powerful systemic therapy, I think the question is whether we need to really strictly define this clinical complete response, and whether we can still use chemo radiotherapy to increase the percentage of patients that we in the end will reach bladder intact event-free survival, which in my opinion is really the goal of these treatments.
So Mikhail, the story to date is that radiation therapy, curative radiation therapy to the bladder, has got quite a patchy background. There hasn't been a randomized trial which compares it successfully to surgery. The two studies, which the two randomized trials that have been performed, BC2001 and Beacon, were both performed 20 years ago, and there's about a 50% 3 years relapse-free survival. More contemporary surgical series from prospective randomized trials show that's only about 20%. There's trimodality data, but that's retrospective, and from selected institutions, that data also shows good relapse-free survival in matched cohort-type trials. But retrospective data, we know, always is associated with potential bias. And there seems to be a lack of consensus on what trimodality therapy really, really means. We had Ananya on the show in a previous podcast who gave a strong argument for radiation therapy. But Jim Catto came on directly afterwards and, you know, really underlined that point around these excellent current outcomes with surgery. Is what you're saying that there's going to be a transformation in the future which will allow us not to do surgery because we are reliant on a new generation of drugs and we're not quite there yet? Or is what you're saying we're there now, but we're not just not doing it properly?
So I think we are to some extent there now, in the sense that, you know, we have the current therapies are working with in this setting. For example, neoadjuvant chemotherapy works also quite well, and we can reach quite high numbers, I think, of bladder intact event-free survival. But I think we will be, what we're doing at the moment is in most places is that we reserve chemo radiotherapy either for the sick and frail or for patients with limited tumors. And I think the place where we have to go to is that we use these therapies for also somewhat higher stage tumors in, you know, a full population and not reserve that for the frail.
So, Mikhail, as our drugs and regimens get better, right, the chemo nevo, EV pembro, et cetera, what you're saying is we don't have to just limit this therapy to the elderly or to the minimal tumor burden patients that actually could have quite a bulky tumor and still do quite fine.
Yeah.
By integrating. Yeah. And so what's, is the idea philosophically then, let's give the maximal amount of therapy to these patients, right? Let's give them the best systemic regimen, consolidative radiotherapy, et cetera. Or is it, what's the least we can get away with and still preserve the bladder, if you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, so that's indeed a good point. So I think that there is a group of patients, but so far we are apparently not fantastic at defining that group of patients where chemo radiation in itself is fine. So I think in the trials, the randomized trials between radiotherapy and chemo radiotherapy, I think the eventual disease-free survival was about 50%, but that's quite a mixed population. And I think, you know, if you define it a bit better, it will be will be much higher if you only do limited T2 tumors and, you know, none of the other risk factors. Mm-hmm. However, I think for the larger tumors, I think we have chances here now that with good induction, we and even without a very strictly defined clinical complete response, we can reach high rates of bladder intact event-free survival. And we're actually testing that at the moment. So what we're doing is the IndiBlade trial. You just mentioned the Nabucco trial in the beginning. So that's just to remind everyone that it's ipilimumab plus nivolumab in the new adjuvant setting where we focused on the stage 3 disease. So including patients with lymph node metastases up to N3. And there we found an approximately 50% of clinical complete response. And in the second cohort of this trial where we tested IP3 versus IP1, a lot of patients who had a good response radiologically also asked, why do I have to, you know, get a cystectomy? So some patients already started refusing. So using that regimen, we set up the IndiBlade trial. So in this trial, we use, again, IpiNivo. And I think this trial is particularly interesting for the concept. I mean, with EV Pembro, it might be that in the future we have even more powerful induction, but we are doing it with IpiNivo. And after evaluation radiologically, so after 3 courses of therapy, we continue in about everybody with chemoradiotherapy unless patients have clearly signs of progressive disease. So we don't say a patient has to have a very clear response. We're just saying if you're not having progressive disease, we continue on with chemoradiotherapy. So, and our endpoint in this trial is bladder intact event-free survival. And we're aiming for bladder intact event-free survival of 70% at 2 years in a, I would say, relatively high-risk population because we're including stage 2 and stage 3A patients, so up to N1 and actually N2, where the lymph nodes are near the bladder, are still allowed.
Mikhail, so what you're saying around Matt's study, you're saying you like the principle of it and it's going in the right direction, but in the end, why wouldn't you want to do that final additional radiotherapy piece?
And exactly.
Just nivolumab alone, it's for you, it's attractive, but why, you know, we're going from huge debilitating surgery, which I think it, you know, I think cystectomy is a big operation.
Yeah.
and you're going from that extreme all the way down to saying we're just going to give nivo, and you want to find this sort of middle road.
Yeah. So I think so if you look at the data, and again, I think it's a great study. Actually, you know, I can reveal it because it's in the paper. I reviewed it. It's a fantastic study, and it answers a lot of, you know, it brings a lot of new questions, but it also, you know, gives a lot of new information about staging and how we should see this. And I think it's really, you know, across the board, great work. But if you look at the you know, the eventual goal, which in my view should be bladder intact and disease free, then, you know, in this clinical complete response group, which was about 40% of patients, out of these 33 patients that reached that, there's still 8 patients who got a cystectomy in the end. So in the end, you end up with 24 out of 76 patients who have, you know, this clinical complete response and no cystectomy in the end, which is 31.5% of the full population. Now, if I were to ask you, you know, in your practice in the UK, if you have a population of patients, you know, a normal muscle invasive disease population, which you are or are not giving the standard chemotherapy, and you give them, you know, you aim to give chemoradiotherapy and everybody who can, what would your expected bladder intact event-free survival in this population be?
I mean, I think the goal you would want, if you're going to pursue this, is I agree, you'd want it to be higher than that.
Yeah, you would want to be like 60 or 70%, right?
I think that's probably right. But the question in the back of my mind, and this is where I wanted to kind of go with this, we've now got 3 studies. We've got EV, well, we've got 5 studies. In fact, what's 8 studies?
But growing by the minute.
Growing all the time. So we've got a series of chemotherapy immune checkpoint inhibitor neoadjuvant trials coming out soon. There's Niagara, there's Energize. So that's Gem, Cis, plus or minus Nevo, plus or minus Atezo, plus or minus Pembro. You know, they finished a long time ago now. We're expecting them to come out in the near future. We then have a second group. Oh, by the way, it's not just neoadjuvant, it's neoadjuvant and adjuvant. and people saying, you know, how much do we need that adjuvant period? And that's an important question. Then we've got this second generation of trials. Again, it's three more studies, sometimes in cisplatin ineligible populations, but not exclusively. There's EV Pembro. There's EV Durva-Tremi. And then finally, the third study, or final study, the eighth study, is atezolizumab or chemo-rad plus or minus atezolizumab in this perioperative space. How do you see these eight trials reading out and changing your current thinking? And how many of these trials do you think are going to be positive for progression-free and overall survival?
Predict the results of eight trials. Go.
That's basically it, Nikhil. No
so pressure. I'll just discuss all eight trials one by one. No, I think for either the chemo plus IO, I think there it's going to be a bit more difficult to predict because, as we all know, some of the metastatic studies were actually negative, and I think the margins are a bit closer. I think for EV Pembro, I would be confident that this should be positive. I think there is one catch that we don't talk that much about, but I think that's around the endpoint, which seems straightforward with event-free survival, but I think it's not at all, because around cystectomy, a lot of things happen with these patients, and it's all about how do you define the events, how this is going to play out in your trial. It could go either direction of improving the experimental arm or improving the standard arm.
Mikhail, we once chatted about OS being an easier endpoint to achieve in these studies. We have had that conversation, and we kind of, DFS or event-free survival is an easier, a faster endpoint, but I think OS might in the end be
Why do you think that?
Mikhail, do you want to explain?
Basically, if it looks straightforward, EFS, but with cystectomy, with such a big surgery, there's a couple of things that can happen. So patients get, powerful induction therapy. All the patients read Matt's paper and they say, well, I seem to have a really good response to therapy. Why have a cystectomy? So, and then a part of the population, and let's say that the chemo plus IO arm is better, then a higher part of that population is going to refuse a cystectomy. And then it's all up to, your protocol. What's an event is, doing anything is probably maybe not an event, but, giving radiotherapy, is that an event? Is,
it is. So in these trials, we've got a problem. Part of the problem in that if you refuse surgery, you then come off, you're not following the protocol, and then you've got an event.
Yeah.
And that's what the FDA will look at.
Do you think that's going to be 5% or more like 40% or something? I mean, I would think it would be low, but I don't know.
It's about 10% who refuse a cystectomy at least. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember and then the study? Other side of the story is that there's patients who are not doing well, and that will be, let's say that's more often in the chemo alone arm, and these patients will, get a result of a cystectomy, which is not very good. And then, everybody panics and all kinds of other strange things happen. They're taking off study to get radiotherapy, or they get all kinds of other treatments maybe. So that also skews your analysis in the wrong direction. So a lot of things can happen. And I think this is a substantial number of patients that will have events, not because of progression around surgery.
I have a question. If you're advocating for consolidative radiotherapy, do you think that benefit and that importance is separate from the adjuvant immune therapy component, which, as Tom said, we don't really know necessarily what it's doing or not doing? So, again, is it maximal they should get consolidated radiotherapy, they should get adjuvant immune therapy, or are those could the adjuvant immune therapy be avoided if you got radiotherapy?
Yeah, I think regardless, it's really questionable if this adjuvant, this maintenance or adjuvant or whatever you want to call it, if you've given four cycles of therapy, so you already had, more than 3 months of IO in the non-metastatic setting, I really doubt whether it's adding anything to continue IO after that. So I think whether you give radiotherapy or not, I think it doesn't really make much of a difference.
I mean, my issue around, I think the neoadjuvant trials have got a really good chance of being positive for EFS. I think they've got a really good chance of being positive for OS as well. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that even if I think, we chatted about this before, I think the GEM-CIS immune checkpoint inhibition combination, it's not synergistic. It's probably a bit antagonistic, a little bit, you know, but at the same time, the response rates are a little bit higher and it's probably a little bit better giving it earlier. But the second part, which is that, you know, the forest plot analysis of those trials suggests that the of the adjuvant trial suggests that the upper tract patients were holding back the bladder patient, the remaining population. Number one. Number two is those patients that got neoadjuvant chemo appeared to do better again on the forest plots of the Atezo and the Nevo trial. And, you know, the neoadjuvant trials are removing those two populations. So even if you're giving just super efficient adjuvant therapy and removing these two cohorts, which seem to be driving the results in a negative direction, the results will be positive. So I think it's a good chance of being positive just by having the right patient population. So I think these trials are going to be positive. And when they are positive, particularly if the PASCR rate is high with the EV Pembro, I think lots of patients are going to come back and say, do I really need my bladder out now?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is going to be, I'm not really sure. And if you put MAT study in there, and then you get ctDNA analysis, and you include that as well, and you include other sort of issues, and the patients look like they're doing really well, you know, I think patients are going to start voting with their feet and not having that cystectomy. And that, I guess, is where this radiation issue comes back in. There's a study called, I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, S1806, which is the SWOG study, which is chemo-rad plus or minus atezolizumab. I think it's only 9 months. It's not the whole year of atezolizumab. But it has completed its enrollment. How important is that trial in scoping the landscape? Again, it's not against surgery. It's against radiotherapy. So it's got all the same potential issues as we've had before.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of trials out there of chemo-rad plus or minus IO. And I think these trials have a decent chance of succeeding. There's a couple of issues that I see. The first one is from a biological, immunological point of view. I think the concept is, to me, a bit difficult that you you usually start it at the same time. I don't know exactly how it is in the Atezo trial, but you basically give immunotherapy, you're hoping for a good, you know, priming and immune response in your tumor, but at the same time you're radiating it every day. So you're irradiating not only the tumor but also your T cells that are emerging. So conceptually, I think this might become a bit less efficacious as that we would like it to be. In the end, you know, you're giving probably IO for a year or so, so probably it will do its work anyway. But this is something that, from an immunological point of view, I'm not sure if it's completely ideal. The second thing that I'm seeing is that I think in patients who have very experienced radiotherapy centers, the schedules have improved, and it makes a big difference for toxicity if you're doing adaptive radiotherapy. And I think in these worldwide trials where you have to, you know, you standardize radiotherapy where everybody's doing the same thing and everybody's doing whole bladder radiotherapy, it might be that we will see more toxicity than a modern radiotherapy center would have at this point. But that's just pure speculation.
Mikhail, what do you think about TAR-210, TAR-200s? There's Sunrise 2, Sunrise 4, both looking at the pretzel in muscle-invasive urothelial cancer certainly in randomized trials. Are these going to be practice-changing? Is the pretzel going to supersede radiation therapy? I think the pretzel is easier to give than radiation therapy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think so. Sunrise 1 is of course, non-muscle-invasive. I think that's basically the optimal situation, I would think, for the pretzel, where it's an intravesical device, and you know, for non-muscle invasive, for obvious reason, it's the right type of disease to test this for. Muscle invasive, I think it's of interest, and we'll have to see the data. I'm a little bit concerned that the efficacy of this drug is only in the inside of the bladder. I don't think it will penetrate far into the muscle layer, so the muscle invasive parts I would think that that is not very efficacious. So there I'm a little bit less optimistic.
So Mikhail, my last question is, are we going to be able to do large randomized trials to settle this, you know, neoadjuvant chemo IO plus minus radiotherapy, et cetera, or are we sort of destined for these sequential single arm trials and then everybody will sort of have their favorite approach?
Yeah. Well, I hope we will design a phase three trial. It's never going to be the type of design that everybody will be happy about. I think cystectomy against chemo radiotherapy is never going to happen. But for example, if you would say Matt's, you know, let's call it Matt's approach with a strictly defined clinical complete response versus consolidation with radiotherapy, you know, obviously for a primary endpoint of bladder intact event-free survival, it would be clear who would be the winner. However, you know, we would have to do these trials with a lot of other endpoints involved, like quality of life, because the premise of this type of approach with no consolidative treatment is that GU toxicity or radiotherapy induced toxicity is bad and that it really makes a difference in patients' quality of life in the end. So we would have to show that. So I think we can do these trials. It's often more difficult to get pharma interested, but I certainly hope we will do these trials.
My last question. Paris EAU on Friday at 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
The 274 adjuvant Nevo, the much elusive, famously elusive overall survival results are being presented. We're also seeing the ctDNA results for Invigor 11, the surveillance component of that, looking at the ctDNA negative patients and their outcome. What are you expecting to see from those two results, number one? So what proportion of ctDNA negative patients do you think are going to relapse, or what would be a good result that would change your thinking? And what sort of survival signals are you expecting from 274, and what proportion of patients do you think should get subsequent immune therapy in those patients from the control arm? Lots of questions, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the last I didn't fully get. That's so for the 274, I mean, just to make it clear, I've not been a part of either trial and I haven't seen the results. For 274, I think that these results are much awaited. I don't know if this is the final official analysis or what kind of data exactly this is, but what I would expect from the curve so far is that the PD-L1 positive group would be positive, and I think the DFS difference there is so high that it's probably will translate in an overall survival advantage. For the PD-L1 negative, I wouldn't be so sure. I think there it would be a close call.
Okay, and then, what proportion of patients do you think on the control arm should get subsequent immune therapy?
You mean as a in the metastatic setting?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's been that big debate recently in the adjuvant renal setting about patients with adjuvant atezolizumab versus placebo and subsequent therapy in the control arm. Many people would say, well, you know, if you relapse with advanced disease, you could salvage patients with immune therapy. What proportion of patients do you think would be a reasonable portion in the control arm to receive subsequent immune therapy?
Yeah, so I think it's about it's probably about 50 or 60% who is relapse free. So about 40 or 50% of the control arm has relapsed, right? Is that correct? About 40%,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and of those 40%, you'd expect most of them to get chemotherapy first line because that's the standard. So you'd expect
unless they had it. So I think the recurrences were mostly in the first year. So patients who had new adjuvant, so this makes it even more complicated. Half of the patients probably had new adjuvant chemotherapy. So those patients would maybe not get new adjuvant chemotherapy as their first subsequent therapy. Of those, you would expect that, you know, there's always some patients who recur so fast that they don't get treatment. So let's say that of that percentage, you would get like 80% should get IO, and from the patients who have not had chemotherapy, probably first they get chemotherapy and then, you know, in the end 50 or 60% gets IO. Is that a good estimate?
Yeah, so basically the answer is very complicated.
The answer is Yeah, we cannot expect 80% for the whole group of recurrences. Yes. I think about 50 to 60% would be reasonable.
Yeah, and we shouldn't overinterpret that data. I think that's important to recognize that, because you're right. Many patients, you know, in the US could get EV as first line if they got neoadjuvant chemo, mm-hmm. and then they relapse with nivolumab and progress, you know, on nivolumab, then EV would be the standard of care. So assuming that all these patients should immediately get
true.
Although I'm guessing it'll be 50 or 60%. That's pretty typical, right, for trials like this. That number seems to be repeated across trials.
But in urothelial cancer, most patients who relapse on a control arm should get a subsequent therapy, but I can see a lot of it being chemotherapy.
Sure.
So I'm happy with that. Let's talk about ctDNA then.
Yeah, I think from what we've seen so far of ctDNA negatives, I would say 10 to 15% relapse.
Yeah. It's actually a bit higher than that in Invigor 10, but about 20%. But you're saying 10%, 10 to 15% would be a good result.
Yeah.
Okay, that seems reasonable. Brian, what do you think?
So I wasn't. So is this trial is apparently already, is it completely enrolled already? And
no, it's not. It's about two thirds of the way through. About 200 patients have been enrolled of about 250. We hope it's going to complete this year, obviously. It's really important that it does.
Yeah,
but what we're doing is it's a big study. It has an intervention component and it has a screening component, and they're completely unlinked to each other. And obviously those patients who are negative, who remain negative, never take part in the trial. So you can analyze those patients whenever you want, and there's no way that they can contaminate the trial population. But I think it is helpful, particularly in view of our earlier discussion, if you have a patient who's come out of surgery, who's had neoadjuvant EV pembro, come out from surgery and is ctDNA negative, and there's only a 10% chance of relapse from there, do they want to go on then and have a year more of adjuvant therapy? And so I think, you know, I think the treatment paradigm that you talked about, which will evolve, it's going to look something like this. I think patients are going to get very, very powerful neoadjuvant therapy. I think many of them are going to be cured with that. I think the role of surgery will diminish. I think continuing immune therapy and monitoring things like ctDNA, maybe cystoscopy, maybe urine as well, to preserve the bladder with or without radiation or the pretzel is how I see this going. And then, of course, there'll be a group of patients who just things don't work, who remain ctDNA positive, who have surgery, who relapse, who die. But I think we can... and we need to work more on them. But I think that's going to be the minority of patients. I think the majority of patients will end up going down a more complex pathway where we'll use the data from these 7 or 8 trials, we'll integrate them to each other to then work out what's best for the patients.
Yeah,
no,
go ahead, Mikhail.
No, I fully agree. I think that there will be a great, you know, the trials will be a bit complicated, but I think it would be a great future where we, for example, say, but patients who are completely clear in ctDNA in urine and plasma, because I think they are telling a different story in bladder cancer, these two measurements, and, you know, good radiological results, they can go maybe into an IO maintenance observant phase, whereas the patients who have some, you know, positivity still, but look like they're... they could go into a chemoradiation consolidation, and, you know, then there's patients who are not doing well at all, and then you can still offer them cystectomy, but probably they won't do very well in the long run.
Yeah, and I agree with that approach. Tom, I was just going to add that I think the ability to salvage patients who do relapse, right, be it locally presumably, will be critical, right? Because patients are choosing not to get the big operation cystectomy, and we're monitoring, et cetera, the, you know, can we salvage those patients and how do we salvage will be critical.
One of the things that I'm not super keen on is if those patients are positive or CTA positive and remain positive, giving more of the same therapy in the adjuvant setting doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah,
I think we should be switching. And that's where I think it's the Moderna study, the CTA positive study, looking at different approaches to CTA positive patients is important. Because I can see, you know, there are in the EV Pembro trials, you're giving adjuvant EV Pembro as well as neoadjuvant EV Pembro, not in the Volga study, but in 303 and 304. And in those trials, I kind of think that actually if you're ctDNA positive and you didn't have a great surgical result, I'm not sure giving more of the same drugs that didn't work before is necessarily the right thing. Maybe that would be a TDXD where you could switch to HER2 ADCs or maybe you should give chemotherapy or a different approach.
Yeah.
Something completely different. Because so I think that so it's going to get more and more complicated. I think it's the most exciting area of urothelial cancer right now.
Yeah, I agree.
Good way to end it.
Fabulous, boys.
Mikhail, thanks for joining. Appreciate the perspective.
Yeah, thanks.